Good afternoon. Come on in, have a seat. Maybe the desk here will hold a couple people. I don't know. I'm Ron Clark.
And I'm Lori Clark.
And we're from Portland, Oregon, the Agape Church of Christ. And we are doing this presentation on the cruciform marriage. We're going to talk today about healthy relationships and then tomorrow about cruciform marriage and ministry. What we're excited about is we do a lot of presentations. We're church planters in Portland, and we do a lot of presentations on domestic violence. We do a lot of work in domestic violence, and I teach a class on that at the seminary. Lori works with a lot of the women coming out. We work with prostitution, trafficking. So whenever we do sessions, when we do them in community agencies, they're full. When we do them for church groups, there's only four or five people present. So this is really exciting to us. We're excited. We just finished a book, Reflections from the Marriage Table. Our experiences of love from marriage, ministry, and family. And we're excited, like Lori said, we're going to talk about positive, healthy things. And so we're excited to do this. So we just finished it. It'll be out in the summer. And we wanted to kind of just do some presentations on that. All right. There you go.
Well, this is our family. We have our oldest son will be 24. He was an only child for 11 years, and then we got these two. After we moved to Oregon, we had Hunter and Caleb, so we have Nathan, Hunter, and Caleb, and this is our oldest son's wife. They started dating when they were 14, and we always said it wouldn't last, and they broke up for 2 weeks when they were sophomores and continued dating, went to the University of Oregon together, and got married their sophomore year. We told them, we said, you know, just make it through your freshman year, you know, let's see. And they did, and so they got married at the end of their sophomore year, so they've been going on 3 years of marriage. So our family is growing, and so we have a big age range in our family. So,
One of the things that we've appreciated, Nyla, our daughter-in-law, her mom died of cancer during finals week. They got 4 years, four-year degree. And she passed away during finals week. And so she's been through a lot, but we've known her since she was, you know, in high school. And she's just been a part of our family, I think, for so long. And so we thought we'd start out a little bit about who we are. I grew up in a family where my dad was a fighter pilot captain. He was verbally, emotionally abusive towards my mom. He was controlling to my brother. I was more like the older golden child kid, so I tended to get away with a lot. And I think the one time I can remember when I was 17, he was attacking my brother, and I stood up to him. And I think everything kind of shifted for me because I learned then at 17, you know, you have to stand up and protect your family, which really, Lori, after being married, Lori was like, that's dysfunctional. That's not healthy. Kids shouldn't have to do that to his dad. But from that point on, you know, I kind of probably became more the controlling one in our family. And so when I got converted in college and started learning a lot from some really, really wonderful families, I was a youth minister in Chillicothe, Missouri, and Lori and I met there. And I remember when we started dating, and then I proposed to her. We'd been out on two dates, but she had a TV. And I didn't. And Van Halen was live, was on that night. And I was like, can I come over to your house and watch TV? And she said, okay. And we got engaged that night. So we'd gone out a couple times before that. But I remember saying to her, I said, we'll talk about this more tomorrow. But I remember saying, how do you feel about being a minister's wife? And I was a youth minister. And she said, I'm fine. I just don't want to be a missionary's wife. And I said, you know, that's okay. We kind of got that out in the open. And one of the things that was hard for me was I was one of those Bible study all the time. I was converted in what was known as the Crossroads Movement. This was a very nice rural church. But I was just very, very work-scheduled, type A personality. And when we first got married, I had to learn to shift and adjust that now we were going to be a team. And we needed to come along together. And so that was the first few years of our marriage were hard for me to learn to just gear down and work with her as a couple. So that's where I came to the table. I brought a lot of dysfunction from my family, and I learned a lot from her and her family on how to be a man that cares and respects for your wife.
And what I brought to the table was I came from a family who my parents were just a year short of their 70th wedding anniversary when my dad passed away. I was the youngest by 20 years in my family. So I was the baby, but I was the only child. So I grew up having everything, and in the church, and a great church, and my family, they were loud and they were big, and we were always all together. And Ron, on the other hand, grew up with just the four of them. And so when he came into, you know, our family, when he got to know him, we were just overwhelming, because we argued, but that's how we talked about everything. We discussed it, and then we went about our business. And he was like, "You just had an argument." I was like, "Yeah, but it's okay. We just talk loud, and, you know, that's how we get our point across." So, in our first few years of marriage, that was hard, because I talk with my hands. I'm not Italian. That's what everybody asks me. So that is what I brought to the marriage, is I thought that's how you worked out things. You just, you know, said what you needed to say, and you went on your way. And I'm very outspoken. And so I have to laugh, because actually what I said was, I'll be a minister, and I drew a minister's wife, and I drew a circle pretty much just around Missouri and said, I don't want to leave outside of Missouri. And then we moved 2,000 miles to Portland, Oregon. So we've been there almost 20 years, and I love it. So I consider myself a little bit of a missionary, since we've planted a church and just kind of done all that on our own. So learn to eat those foods.
And we've, in our history together, we spent time in rural congregations, and I went on to Harding Grad School and got my master's and my doctorate. Mm-hmm. We moved to Portland. We worked at a big church for 8 years, and then 9 years ago, we planted an inner city church, Agape Church of Christ, through the Kairos Network. And again, we'll talk more about that. But we do a lot of work with abuse, homelessness, trafficking, poverty. We have a lot of people that come in that are, you know, they're high up in businesses, but they have a heart for the poor. And so we found that working together, we've been able to complement and strengthen each other. And our ministry together has really been a great blessing. And that was something I had to learn, because, you know, most of us in our schools don't teach male ministers, you know, to partner with your spouse, you know, to be together. We don't teach our male ministers to be patient and compassionate with the whole family and move together as a team. And so one of the things that we've, or three of the things that we've noticed as we worked with reading the material, biblical studies, working with unhealthy families, but working with healthy families, reading material, we kind of mentioned this in our book, that there's three points that we see from the scriptures that are really important in marriage. The first one's in Genesis chapter 3, when God creates the man and the woman for the man, right? And do you remember the term that he, you know, got they use in the scriptures for Eve? A helpmate, okay? But the Hebrew is, it's a helper fit, or the Hebrew is complement. So it's the idea that she's a mirror image. That male and female, actually, they're not so much different, they complement each other. And they bless each other in a way. And that's one of the first things that we notice from the biblical scriptures, that also working with families, is that the two can come together and complement each other, build each other up. We do that in premarital counseling. One of the things that we'll do is just have a couple draw a line down the middle and write, how do you complement each other? And they start thinking as a team.
What I'm finding out working with domestic violence and with women, I'm getting a lot of women now that have been married 25 plus years that have said, I've had enough. I'm done. What do I do? And they've already walked out the door. And so some of them have wanted to work on it, but that part was missing the whole time, was the complimenting. They didn't, you know, they weren't taught that. That wasn't their interpretation of the scripture. And so I think that is very important. And so we talk a lot about how do you compliment somebody? Not how do you submit, or how do you mimic somebody, but how do you compliment? So.
And we stress that as opposed to competition. Because what we see and typically this happens in the first few years of marriage, it's a lot of competition. How do we compete against each other? How do we put each other down? I can say this because this individual's not in here, but I was in the bathroom and got too many towels, and so I set them by the sink, and this older, nice gentleman looked at me and said, "Well, you can tell your wife you're good for something, aren't you?" You know, and I mean, we joke about that. We called it good old boy humor in Missouri. But really, it's putting each other down. And when we start competing with each other, that begins to affect our marriage, our relationship. But, you know, what we want to do is get couples to think, how can we complement each other? You know, for instance, there's been times when we've worked together with kids. when she was teaching one night at a bigger church we were at, she was teaching the kindergartners, or preschool. She's a preschool teacher, and so I was helping her. And one of the kids was eating Play-Doh. And I said, that kid's eating Play-Doh. And I said, quit eating that Play-Doh. I said, I'm going to kick you out of class. Because I taught college, Cascade College. That's what we did when kids act up. We kicked them out of class. I'm like, but Dad, I'm going to kick you out of class. And Lori's like, you don't kick a kindergartner out of class. Because that's what she wants to do. You sit there with her and hold her till you know, and let her eat the Play-Doh. And I was like, whoa, you know, that's a neat way to look at stuff. But we found ways, you know, how do we complement each other? Each person helps the other one to be better. Each person helps to identify our vulnerabilities. And what we see in society is a lot of guys aren't taught to listen to their fiance, their girlfriend, their spouse. You know, what do you think? You know, what is your opinion? You know, or this is how you make me feel. When you said that, this is how I felt. And teaching individuals to think, wow, I need to listen to that. I think it's something that we see.
Along the lines of having three boys, we do a lot of sports. And, you know, I like to think it's 2016, and we've come a long way with not putting women down, and I can't walk off of any of our sports fields without hearing some parent, usually male, saying something about our team happens to have light blue shirts. They're light blue. They're 11-year-olds.
We didn't ask one, so.
And he said, well, at least we're not in those girly colors. And it made me stop because the boys around him all, and I thought, what does that have to do with it? What does it matter? And I say that because I think that's just, you know, enforcing it even now in this day and age that when we grow up and we have girlfriends and we have, you know, try to have healthy relationships, I think that's a barrier that gets in the way. It's everything that's put in, it's our put downs and our, to women, to females in general. So that's how I feel. I think that's hard when we do premarital counseling. I find it hard a lot of times to see the couples find they can complement each other, but they don't understand quite what complementing each other means. So
I don't know how many times I'll have a dad help and he'll be like, come on ladies, and it's like I have to take him aside and say, you know, we don't talk to boys that way, you know. Because if you think about it, when you take a group of boys and say, you're not playing well, you're playing like a bunch of girls, what kind of message is being said to those boys? What do you think?
Girls are not good.
Girls are not good.
Okay. They're inferior.
Inferior. What's that?
Lack of respect.
The lack of respect. Okay. But it also teaches boys that boys who act what's considered feminine, so we start labeling boys as feminine, then are weaker and not valuable. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, we call this the man box in domestic violence, but with guys start learning at a very young age that this is the behavior of men and this is the behavior of anybody that's female. And so they start labeling. But in a marriage, we complement each other. We respect men respect women, women respect men, because we all bring something wonderful to the table. You know, like I learned that, you know, having a loud conversation in a family doesn't mean that something really bad's happening. You know, in my family, that's how it was. Shut up, you know, you're losing your temper, calm down. We learned that they just talk loud because they're excited about it. And I had to learn that. But that's something that we brought to each other's table. Second point that we see, submission is talked a lot about in churches. But how often do you hear mutual submission? Everybody wants to talk about Ephesians 5:22 on, but nobody talks about verse 21. Submit to each other out of respect for Christ. And so then Paul very quickly says how the women submit to the men, and then very not quickly says how the men submit to the women. And this is something that we find also needs to happen in marriages, that both people see, I'm submitting to her, I'm submitting to him, we are submitting to each other, and this is a teamwork.
And working at church with some of our women that have been in prostitution in the past, and some still are, that's a terror. They don't get that concept at all, because it is about submission, and so when they actually get into a healthy relationship, they try to sabotage it. They try to leave when it's not, you know, because they think it's going to get to that point. And teaching healthy mutual submission is hard. And it's even hard with people that have been in the church for years, because I think that's so ingrained in us to to just think that that's what it means, and the spiritual head. And we have a lot of public figures, actors who come out, you know, that are on the Christian side, and they say, you know, well, the men need to. And we always talk about what the women should be doing, but we don't address what the men should be doing. And I think that that's where our society and church and as a whole is hard on that. And so we really do talk a lot about mutual submission.
And a major reason we do that is because the first question we get from a lot of guys is, you know, well, aren't you going to tell the women to submit? And don't you believe the women should submit? And I've always wondered, why do you think that's such a big issue in our culture, that men make sure women submit? Why do you think that happens?
I think part of it is they look at the Old Testament, and the woman was more like a possession. And in Christianity, you're partners.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people take the Old Testament and throw it in the New Testament and say, you know, women, you've got to submit to the man. And I think submission to me is humbling yourself to the other person. I don't have to be the most important person in this union at this time. I can be the weaker vessel and give my husband some power. And he likewise can do the same thing.
That's a good point. That's good. For the people on tape, that was that, that's, you know, men tend to look to, or people tend to look to the Old Testament and rather than seeing the New Testament as partnering, right? Okay. Yes?
Well, submission is mentioned in the New Testament, but farther on, it talks about the man should, but they don't use the word submit.
Right.
If I remember correctly.
Right.
They use something else.
So he says likewise. Mm-hmm. So it's the idea of,
right.
Here's a statement, women and also men. Yeah.
Yeah. But it doesn't say submit. It says
love your wives as Christ
loves. Love your wives?
Like God loves the church.
Yes, like Christ loves the church.
Right. So the actual word submit is not in there.
No.
For the man. So you have to read through that.
Yeah, and what's neat is he uses two words that in the Roman Empire would be feminine words. Nurture and cherish. And he tells men in the Roman Empire to nurture and cherish. And I think there's the idea of submission. That how do men submit to their wives? They love them, they nurture them, they cherish them. So we don't hear that a lot, right? Okay, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that it helps when husband and wife have the same goals and dreams. You know, because it's like when you're sitting there, whether it's something like basic household tasks, like doing a budget together, you know, yeah, that we both have equal input on a budget, mm-hmm. so that we decide how money is going to be spent, so that we can both arrive at this goal that we're wanting to reach.
Right.
Making sure the house is clean, or making sure there's food on the table. That it's not just one person's role.
Right.
That each of us have gifts and talents that make us better suited to do one thing or another.
Right.
Right.
And I think that goes back to, it's a journey. I think I look back to, you know, 28 years ago, and the things that were so important to us then may not be now, but we still have just as hard of road. And I think you're right when you said always work on it. And I think that's a lot of times, and I'm sure we've all heard this, the kids leave home and people look at each other and go, oh. And I'm thinking, you know, our kids are never going to leave home. They should be gone by now. But I can't wait. I mean, I'm just thinking about, but I also know that comes with another set of challenges, too. And when we, you know, retire and when we do. And I think it's good. And I always look to, and at Agape, for as small as we are, we have two or three older couples that have chosen to, that's their commitment, is to helping our young marriages and to helping, because we're losing that. I think we're losing our mentors in this. And that's a really big platform we've started looking at, because I look down the road in the church and I think, you know, we still need mentoring. And so I want to make sure I pass that on. And that's something to think about, to do, and to look around and find a couple. Because it's a journey. It's always something. It can be the mundane things, or it's the hard things that come up in your marriage. So,
yeah, that's a good point. Graham had his hand up too.
For many men, the number one need that they have is to feel respected. And unfortunately, whenever you're talking about submission, oftentimes you get two completely opposite camps, which is the men should, women should always submit to men, and then you have the women should never submit to men. And it almost is if you're, the question that you're asked, are you going to tell women to submit? It almost is like, okay, which side are you on?
Yeah.
And you almost have to help people reprogram themselves to say, no, this is not about the civil war between who submits. This is a mutual submission to where both sides have to give a little bit to get the right way.
Because, again, if we're competing, then submission becomes a divisive word. If we're complimenting each other, you know, I mean, if my best friend critiques me and tells me, you know, I've done something that's not good, if we're complimenting each other, that should, you know, the Bible says a wise person listens to advice in Proverbs. Okay, you have a good point, but, you know, what we deal with is a lot of, especially younger men, nobody's going to tell me what to do, or, you know, how dare she tell me what to do? It's like, I mean, she's your friend, she's your partner, right? So if she says that, then sure, you should listen. That makes sense. That's just wisdom.
I was going to say, I think one thing I found in our marriage is the complimenting each other is the biggest bond that we have. Because my husband's good at certain things, and I'm good at certain things, and we started teaching together in the same school. And for a while, we got to be partners.
Yeah.
And my husband was very good with the kids in certain areas, and I was very good with different kids in this. And so if I had trouble with somebody, my husband would say to that child, "Why are you giving Miss Australia a hard time? What is going on?" And then I would do the same thing for the kids that responded to me. And I said, it worked out very well because the kids saw that we cared about each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was an example that most of them didn't have at home. That their parents would care what's happening to the other person.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that in ministry. There's been some people, you know, that respond to me better than they would Lori, and some people respond to Lori better than they would to me. And there's been times when I've said, you know, you make the call on this, and it's worked out well that way. So compliment, mutual submission, and then the third one, in Ecclesiastes, we look at the Ecclesiastes and we think, oh, that person's a pessimist, you know, bogus is basically what he's saying. You know, everything's bogus, everything's vanity. But there are these sections that say, you know, because of this, enjoy, there's nothing better to do than to enjoy life. And in Ecclesiastes 9, enjoy the, you know, life with the wife of your youth, always be clothed in white. So there's a concept in the Bible that families are something we're to enjoy. And if I go back and look in our marriage photo album, the elder of the church who did our photos there has a picture of me trying to get out the window while all the groomsmen were holding on to me. And there's a concept that's being pushed that, you know, guys are supposed to avoid marriage, you know. When Ecclesiastes says there's something wonderful about our family, right? Our marriages. We should enjoy that. It's supposed to be something we have joy in. And Terrence Real, who's a therapist, he wrote a book, How Can I Get Through to You? One of the things that he says is two-thirds of marriages he's found, people are miserable. And he says the thing that he's concerned about is longevity isn't always making marriages better. Which, when we read that, we thought, wait a minute, because we've been saying in the church, you know, the longer you're married, the better it is. But we're beginning to talk about leaders and couples we've known that are miserable. They've been married a long time, and they'll say, well, we've been married 30 years, that makes us a good, healthy role model, but they're miserable. And their kids are miserable. And the kids are talking, you know, dad's a terrible dad. Or mom, you know, does this to dad. And suddenly we begin to realize that there were a lot of people that were unhealthy in their marriages. And, you know, we would bring that presentation up. We'd have people argue with us. But then others in the group would start raising their hands and say, this is what I experienced as a kid in my home. And my parents were miserable. They were married 30, 40 years, but they were miserable, you know. And we began to realize that there's something about marriage that we're called to enjoy marriage. Go ahead, that's it. Because, you know, and even with leaders, we've had friends that are in leadership. We've sometimes sat down and said, are we odd because we're having all of these couples at church that are having all of these serious issues? and there's fighting and there's tension. And we've even begun to see some of our friends in ministry who are separated now and going through that. And there's this lonely feeling that we should, you know, we should be having this feeling of marriage is great, family's great, we love our families, but sometimes we get to this point where we feel like, man, you know, what's happening here? You know, marriages and families are not healthy, you know. And I think the biblical text says that marriages are to be enjoyed. You know, we want to work for healthy marriages. We don't want to just fake it till we make it.
Mine's on the next one.
Oh, yours on the next one. Okay. All right, onward. All right, so, okay, go ahead.
Well, we're intentional. Everything, and it sounds funny when I say everything, pretty much everything we do is intentional. We have to be. We have really great boundaries. I know that's down. And someone talked earlier, we always hear the word boundaries thrown around. And I'm a big person for that because it's my fault then if I haven't set a good boundary. And the work we do, we couldn't do it without strong boundaries. And I know people will come up and say, how do you do all you do? And I said, we pretty much, after 6 o'clock in the evening, it's family time. Or it's stuff we do with our kids. And it just has to wait. It's not, you know, I don't do anything that's life-saving or changing. I can give people, I can send them to the right agencies, but I'm not saving a life. I'm not a doctor. So Ron is, but like our oldest son said when he got his doctorate, well, you can't help anybody. So it's a lot of money down the drain. So, but we set really, really strong boundaries. And we move them for some people, and they know, they can tell. But we've had to. And I've had people make fun of us and laugh and say, well, we can't do it. But we've made it work, and it's worked for us. It doesn't work for everybody. But where I work, I have friends, and they're not close with their husbands. You can tell. And they laugh at me because Tuesdays is Ron's day off. And so they know not to ask me to do anything after we get off work because we spend our time together. We used to have the whole day off. I went back to full-time teaching. So we just get a half a day before the kids come home. But they know now. They just go, oh, don't ask Lori. She's not going to go. And I'm like, yeah, I'll do it next time. I'll do it on Wednesday. But so we, you know, it's funny. People will start respecting your family boundaries. And I didn't tell a lot of people because writing this book is, I'm not the writer in the family. I've done it. I check that off my bucket list. And it was hard for me. Ron, it was easy. It was hard. It's always hard for me to do that. And I didn't tell a lot of people I was doing it, and Ron put it on Facebook, and a lot of my coworkers were like, you're kidding me, I want to read it. You know, we know that you have a healthy family, and I said, well, you know, I didn't want to go around talking about it because it's a little embarrassing, but it's funny now, that's been my way in, that they're actually now, they respect my boundaries, but they want to know more about it. So I'm very intentional with what we do on that end of it, and I think both of us, you do a good job, but in the beginning, it was always me going, nope, Ron, we need to do this, and now Ron is the keeper of, nope, we don't do that, you know, so.
Yeah, I spent all this time writing heavy theology and abuse books and biblical studies books. Nobody buys them. Here we sit down and do this marriage book, and everybody, oh, I want a copy of that. It's like, okay. Lori brings up a good point with boundaries. Not just boundaries around your family, but there's supposed to be within a family what we call a parental boundary, sibling boundaries, where the kids have their own relationship and the parents have their own relationship and the kids don't get to come in there. And so what we work, we set boundaries with each other so that we can address the children together, you know, our boys together. They can't manipulate us against each other because what happens often is if Lori and I are having a disagreement and we get upset with each other, oldest child, a lot of times one of us starts confiding to them and we call it triangulation. And pretty soon I'm talking to the oldest child and then Lori's talking and the oldest child kind of sees themselves as a peacekeeper. They come between us. But then the oldest child, a lot of times the oldest child starts doing a lot of adult behavior. And this is where sometimes we'll counsel families and the oldest child, son or daughter's, you know, drinking, doing drugs, at-risk behavior. And a lot of times we can very quickly get mom and dad to sit down together and start talking and find out mom and dad's relationship has become very strained. And so one of the kids has now come into that boundary area. So boundaries are important, that we have boundaries together, that we work together to strengthen our relationship. We let the kids be kids. And then when they go off and have their own families, you know, With her daughter-in-law, yeah.
I was going to say, it blindsided me. I have three boys. Couldn't wait to have that daughter-in-law. Known Nyla her whole, 14 years, since she was 14. And when her mother passed away, I never wanted to step into that role because that's not the type of relationship we had. But a few times she'd come to me and want to complain about our oldest son, and I'd listen, and I'd think, well, yeah, I agree with you, but I wasn't going to say that out loud. Something just told me don't. And so finally I just had to have the talk with her. You know what? I love him, and I understand he can be that way, but you're going to have to find an aunt, another person to do that, because I don't want to ruin our relationship with that, because, then it goes back to you guys make up over whatever you were fighting about, and I'm still mad about it. And a lot of times I would take her side, because I'd think, well, yeah, I could see that. But I had to learn that really fast, because that kind of blindsided me, because I almost got caught up in that. Oh, yeah, I get it. I get he can be that way. Yeah, he's, that's his, he thinks he's charming. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was just funny how I caught myself and just sat her down and said, I need to just tell you, I don't want to be your mom. I've been your friend for a long time now. So I think that was good, and I'm glad I caught that, because I think that is always a recipe for disaster, no matter whose side you take. So,
yeah, and strangling is a major issue in families, or in divorced families, where it's just me and my kids, and I'm angry with my ex-spouse, so I start talking to that one child, and then they become my little confidant, my partner. And then when I find somebody and I fall in love with them and I get married, what happens? See, now there's tension between there, because that child, what I need is for them to be a child and to be with their brothers and sisters, for me to be an adult, have adult relationships, romantic relationships, and keep that separation. And that's an important, that opens the home to be very safe and sacred. With intentionality, we believe that if parents would just think as parents, or spouses would think as spouses. I'm married. So how would my wife feel about me having a long, in-depth conversation with this other female? And how would my wife feel if I have this long, in-depth conversation with this female and don't tell her about that? And how would my wife feel if I start looking at this on the internet? And a lot of the things that happen when we talk with couples, there wasn't the intentionality of I'm married, so I'm going into this as a married person, Or I'm going to purchase. There was a situation where a family at our church owned a bike shop. And one of the ladies was talking, and she said, what do you think about this bike? And, it was really a nice bike. It was like $800. And I was like, well, that looks great. She goes, I'll put you on a payment plan, and won't give you any interest because you're our minister. I thought, well, that sounds great. So I said, okay. And I went home. And, I told Lori about it. I said, I'm going to get an $800 bike, and this is going to be cool. And I said, I'm going to save gas. And she said, I thought we were going to talk about any kind of major purchase like that. And I thought, you're right. And I did. I called the lady back, and, oh, no, you're going to go to Walmart and buy a different bike. I said, no, I won't. And I just said, I'm just telling you, I didn't talk with Lori about it. And, that was a bad call. And, it was hard for her to understand, but, we had made that decision, and I wasn't thinking like a husband, I wasn't thinking like a partner when I got into that decision. And we believe that if couples were to go into situations as fathers, mothers, parents, husbands, wives, and think about, this is who I am, so how am I going to approach that? That would make a big difference in outcomes, I think, in what happens, situations. Whether it's affairs, unhealthy behavior, at-risk behavior, so forth, most of it happens because of our intentionality. Presence, being present. That's difficult today, isn't it? We can all be in the same room and be looking at stuff happening, talking with somebody other end of the globe, yep, and not even be talking. When I was a kid, it was like the TV. My dad always talked about the TVs. TV's destroying the dynamic of this family. It's like, man... He would be crazy now knowing what's out there. But, we can all be in the room and connected and not be connected, right? And trying to get people to think, how are we present with our individuals?
And, of course, our cell stuff, cell phones. And it's hard. It's hard for us. I'm great about telling the kids to do it, but then they catch me over here. I just need to check this. Well, so, somebody's... And that's a hard boundary keeper because, it's just a text message I'm returning. or it's just this email I'm going to shoot back, or they just messaged me on Facebook, that's all. Or, and I've had to learn that, and I like to think that I'm not a tech person, but sometimes I act like I can't live without my phone. And we drove down here from Portland and brought our two younger boys, and you know, we kind of put it away a couple of days, all of us, and we really have had a great time, and the world went on without us, and nobody needed anything, and so, but it's hard. Being present is hard for anything. Even in our, I found out for our adult kids, it's been hard. So yeah.
That wonderful Pepperdine Wi-Fi. The boys like, it's not working. I was like, hey, it's not our problem. You know? Good, they're not connected here. So, another thing we've talked about with presence is, like, you know, I made a decision when we were married. I wasn't going to miss anybody's birthday or any special holidays, and that was really hard because you know our boys have. I don't know why our boys are born at the same time of some major conference somewhere in the world. And I came to realize there's always a conference to go to. There's always a place to go speak. And, you know, there were, you know, or, you know, 6 months, you know, in a 6 month window when Lori was pregnant, you know, no traveling. And I found that in the beginning that was really hard because I said, I'm going to be there. And, you know, there was even a time when I was speaking at a national marriage and family conference. And, I told them I can do this day because I got to leave because my son's 16th birthday is there. And they scheduled me on that day, and I said, I won't be there. And the person and the secretary was upset with me and just said, well, you already made the commitment, but if you don't want to come there, then you know, that's just tough. We're going to keep you on the schedule. So, okay. So I emailed the director and said, hey, I won't be there because of this. And I got an email 30 minutes later saying, we've changed the date. You can speak on this day. But I think if we're in, that's, again, intentional about being present. If we decide to be present for our families, and we know that's not true with military. There's some people that have to, you know, people that work, you know, certain schedules where they're going to be gone. But if families would be concerned about being present, you know, how am I going to be there? Because it's not about whether it was fun. I mean, nothing more exciting than a McDonald's birthday party with, you know, 5-year-olds. But the point is, they're glad you're there. And it means a lot to them, and being there with your family. So when we're intentional, when we decide to be present, when we set boundaries, we believe that, you know, that our families can have a very safe, and we call it in the book, sacred home. Safe and sacred is the same thing. We'll talk more tomorrow about how that works in with the church and with ministry. But we find that we want our families and our homes to be a safe and sacred place. And we use the marriage table because the dinner table was a major event in our family. Yeah, we made the dinner table kind of a place where we could just kind of center at everything.
I love that picture because growing up, my parents had a huge kitchen. It was a small house, but at their table. And anytime anybody was there, whether my mom was cooking, doing dishes, somebody was always sitting at the table talking to her. Or my dad, when Esther retired, especially, it's where he played solitaire. He taught my boys to play solitaire there. And for me growing up, I remember things like that. And I think about over the years, the people that we had in our homes around our table. And I just think the table is a sacred place for that. I think that if we look at things, and instead of, there's a comment I've seen that said, instead of building higher fences, we need to extend our tables and invite people to our tables. And I think sometimes we overlook inviting our families to our tables. And that doesn't mean eat every meal. We do 4 meals a week at least at the table. It's hard sometimes because life does get in the way, but we do 4 meals at least. And, you know, we do ups and downs. And I thought they got too old for it. I thought, well, we started that when you guys were little. And, you know, halfway through the meal, one of them will say, what was your today? Well, and I think, wow, you don't have to do that. You're a teenager. But, you know, they want to know. And it's just, you know, we say whatever. We didn't have one. We, you know. So I don't realize the seeds that were planted, they still go. But I think a table is such a reminder that we need to invite everybody to our tables. It's, you know, it's like our stories are. So, and I think in church planting, we've had people around our table that I know I wouldn't have had around my table before. And I love that. I love to picture my house as a safe and sacred home. And I have a story. Thanksgiving is open. We don't have boundaries of Thanksgiving. Anybody, everybody can come to our house for Thanksgiving. Christmas is our time and some other holidays. And you know which story I'm telling. And we had a family come, and they brought a lady that had been coming to Agape. She was a witch. And she
turned us into a newt. That's how we all knew.
She was a psychic. And it was just funny because she walked into our home, and I'd only known her a few times. She'd been coming to Agape, and she goes, "I'm just at peace here." Mm-hmm. And I thought, thank you. That's what I want to hear. I don't care. And I love that. I love the fact that people can be at peace in our home. And I work hard for that. But another funny story to that is we played Trivial Pursuit after that, and she was on my team. And we were losing, and I looked at her and said, "I thought you were psychic. Why aren't we winning?" But anyway. So then she left. But I think that's something to strive, is to have a safe and sacred home. Whether it's a one-person home or a home with, 15 people in it, I think that you can, cultivate that. So.
Yeah, that same day we had the couple that both he and she were sold into prostitution at 13. They found each other like 40 and got married, and so they'd come and they were down with our kids playing games with them, and the boys just loved them, and it was one of those many meals that we've had where we've been able to open our table up, and our boys have witnessed that. Our neighborhood block parties we have, all the neighborhood comes and our boys see that as well, and we found that not only was the dinner table something that we kind of. Because one of our dates before we were married was at my dinner table. So we've eaten together from the way back in the beginning, and the table has just been a common element. And, the ups and downs, it's when you can deal with problems for the day. When your kids are having trouble when you're talking at the dinner, because they open up about things. Now our son and daughter-in-law come back, and we have meals together. They bring friends, and suddenly that table becomes a place where people talk. They share ideas, and you can actually parent very well at the table. And that creates a safe and sacred home so that hopefully when the kids leave home, they can at least see that mealtimes are a time to come together and connect as a family, and it becomes a very safe place. So I think we've covered all the material we had for this time. So we have a few minutes left, 5 minutes left. We can turn that off. And I don't know, do we want to take questions or... Do you have any questions or yes?
What's your advice for handling conflict? Because obviously going to arise, and that's okay. An issue that we have is okay. Dealing with conflicts.
At first, we didn't. And over the years, and as Ron worked on his pastoral counseling, we're good at listeners. I think and that's taken a lot of time. And so one thing that we've found, and this is really as... And if we do argue, we now kind of just walk away, and one of us will come to the other one and we'll say, "Is it safe to talk right now? Are you still feeling?" Because, if the other person is still mad, it's not safe. And sometimes we don't even know what we're talking about after that. Or sometimes one of us will say, "Yeah, it's time to talk about it." And at first, I resisted it because I'm the one that hates little phrases and, "Is it safe to talk now?" But I like it now. And now it's funny because, I'll say, "Is it okay? Can we do, is it a good time?" And, now it might just be 10 minutes later. But that's how I've tried to teach people, is say, just give that person a time to cool off, or give yourself time to cool off, especially. So I don't know if that... For me.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
And sometimes it's like, when you click your mouse in your computer and it starts spinning. Some people process things really fast. Others, it takes a while. And so it's like clicking that mouse. You start, and the other person's trying to. That's where we say, I need to step away and calm down. We can come back and talk. If you have kids, one of the best things we can do for our kids is let them see we've resolved an issue. Too often people go off and they don't want to argue around the kids. And the kids see you argue, but they don't see. And this is what we find with domestic violence. Kids have witnessed the violence, but they never saw the reconciliation, or they've never seen, And so what we want to do is come back and say, "We've made up," or, "This is how we've made up." And the kids, we're not talking about violence, dangerous violence. But what we've been able to do is show people we've resolved this issue, and we've worked that out. So the kids can learn to do that as well. Yes.
I would say it's just as important to let the kids know that they can see conflict.
Yes.
I've seen marriages that are putting our own where they never saw any conflict. And little did they know that there was some. Little did I know that there was some I didn't sense it. But one of the things that you just commented, take that time and come back later. it is really important to understand how each other translates things, because if we take a break and you step away, I think, you know,
exactly.
Understand how your spouse thinks too.
Exactly.
And kind of the whole foundational thing about what you talked about is, I think so many of us, even Christians, we do not understand what marriage is.
Right.
We shouldn't be getting married because we don't know what it is. Right. So until we understand what it isn't, like most of us don't know what it really is. And going back later and doing Gary Thomas's Sacred Marriage for us. You know, if we'd have read that and understood that at the age of 19, most of us, our lives wouldn't be in a lot of the problems that we have. Because once we sense that total frustration and, you know, what's going on, we would start there and understand. If we knew what marriage was, we'd wait 5 years and get married. Or we'd wait 10 years and get married. Or we'd be healthy and get married.
I heard a great, today in a class, he's in here right now that taught it, that he talked about when he does premarital counseling. You know, now the term starter marriages. You know, some people are expecting to be married with 2.8 times, and that's true. I've seen that, and even in the church, our kids that are out there. So I think that's true. We don't know what marriage is anymore. So that's correct.
And we say marriages are relationships to be enhanced, not institutions to be preserved, because we want people to see marriage as a relationship. It's a partnership. It's a teamship. Yep. So one other
question.
Yeah.
You've been married 29 years. Have you found that in your complimenting each other, that you have learned from each other and you're switching places in some?
Yeah, this is not my wheelhouse, talking in front of people at all. But because of Ron going, just do a little bit, just help me a little bit, that's how I've grown, I think, a lot.
We would never have a ministry to homelessness. If it would have been me, those of you that knew me from teaching at Cascade, I have learned to be so much more patient and understanding and okay with the church not becoming a mega church, but just ministering to people. The research that Gottman, I think, says the longer couples are married who complement each other, the healthier sexually they are. So if guys want to have a healthy long-term sexual marriage, we want to be partners and listen to our spouse and have a complementary relationship. Because the ones where they have the submission thing, it reaches a point where they don't have intimacy when they get older. And a lot of guys are, you know, a lot of guys are telling me, "Oh, I'm not having sex with my wife," and I'm talking with them and find out it's because, you know, you're an ogre, you know. But if you have a relationship where you love each other and respect each other, the older we get, the better the intimacy is. And I think that's powerful.
Got to wrap it up.
We've got to wrap it up. Thank you very much for your time. We'll do part two on ministry.